Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Very exciting time, folks. We are on the verge of NBA training camps opening by Monday. All 30 teams will have had their media days and gotten going on training camps. And we will start having basketball news to discuss instead of, I don't know, scandals about owners and coaches and stuff. It'll be nice to talk about just hoops. In the meantime, one team has already finished its training camp. That would be the NBA referees. They were hunkered down all week in Newark, New Jersey, doing their reviews and film sessions and training, getting ready for the new season. New rules, new interpretations, points of emphasis, all that stuff. Here today, back on the pod to tell us all about it, is the head of officiating, actual title, senior vice president, head of referee development and training, Monty McCutcheon. No one explains the rules and the job better than Monty, and we had a lot of fun stuff to discuss, including, of course, the take foul, the NBA, trying to get that out of the game, as I think everybody who watches the game would love to see happen. I think we're going to see a lot less of it. Teams will be penalized for take fouls this season. We will get into the details. Bench decorum. You might recall the Mavericks being fined not once, not twice, but three times in the playoffs because their bench players were standing and encroaching on the court and distracting the opponent and doing all kinds of other nonsense. The NBA wants to clean that up too. The referees will be the first line of defense there. Also, coming soon to an NBA court near you. This was news to me. A blue light. Yes, there's a blue light is going to be on the scorer's table. Why a blue light? Where did the green light for coach reviews go? Actually, it didn't go anywhere. It's going to be there too. Monty will explain it all. It's a lot of fun stuff to get into today. Before we get into that, a quick reminder, Sports Illustrated and Triumph Books have collaborated on a great new book about the history of the Lakers. It's called The Greatest Show on Earth. I was honored to write the foreword for it. Now available for pre-order with a 30% discount. Here's how you do that. Go to triumphbooks.com, search for Greatest Show on Earth. You can also find a direct link to the book in the summary of this podcast. You can also just type in bit.ly/Lakers75. That will take you directly to it. When you get to checkout, use the discount code Lakers30. Again, triumphbooks.com or the bit.ly link, bit.ly/Lakers75. Discount code Lakers30 for a 30% discount. It's a great book. Some of the best sports writing about the Lakers that's ever been in the pages of SI. If you're a Laker fan or just a fan of great sports writing, you'll love it. Go check it out. Okay, my conversation with Monty McCutcheon is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, please welcome back to the podcast a fan favorite. And I do mean this because when I tweeted it out yesterday, Monty, I had people, to the extent that Twitter can cheer, people were cheering. Favorite podcast of the year. A couple of them even said, the people love you. Monty McCutcheon, head of officiating for the NBA, welcome back and looking sharp as hell as usual. I am in my usual just drab Brooklyn wear, and you've got the bow tie going. You've got the I don't know how to describe the suit. I'm incapable because I don't have the sartorial sophistication. So you can tell this is a podcast, not video. You tell the people what you're wearing because I don't have the vocabulary.
I'll start with saying thanks for having me. I wore my customary plaid in various multicolored Technicolor. Although I have to say, Howard, I don't have the best outfit on. Your Block Charge t-shirt is something that warms my heart. Hopefully you didn't call a blarge and you made a choice, which is what officials have to do. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I hope your fans do enjoy the things that we get to discuss, educate the public about our work, demystify some of our work, accept some of the imperfections of our work, and show how we try to get to good work. We're at our referee preseason meetings right now, so we're looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of plays this week. On various topics, all of our points of education, which I'm sure we'll get into, as well as some new rules that we have and some new interpretations of situations we have. And it'll be an exciting hour for us.
Absolutely. And I think that's why people love hearing from you, because you always do such a great job, I think, of breaking it down, explaining it, and always in a way that, like, your humility always comes through. And this is why you were a great referee on the floor for all the years that you were an official before moving to Olympic Tower, is that players and coaches understood, like, I can have a conversation with Monty. He's going to explain in a very dispassionate way. And listen, this is how the rule is. This is how I had to apply it. And I think that always comes through when we have our conversations, which I appreciate. And I think NBA fans appreciate. So thank you. So we are here. By the way, shout out to Rex Chapman for the Block Charge t-shirt and his, I think it's his foundation that created us a few years back.
I may or may not have missed a few calls on Rex.
And if I understand the mentality of players and former players, he will probably remember exactly blow by blow what those were and why he was the aggrieved party.
I'm a little bit like a cornerback in the NFL. I try to forget my mistakes. some of them were so egregious, I have to live with them the rest of my life. Yeah. But that's for a discussion for Rex and I to have at some point.
players never forget. Neither do coaches. So we are recording this at Referee Camp. This is an annual event, without going into chapter and verse on this, but a real quick just primer for the listeners about why you bring all the refereeing staff together every September, this time in beautiful New Jersey. As Jim will tell you, Jim LaBombard, NBA PR, sitting here. I'm still bitter that you guys moved us out of Brooklyn again. That was much more convenient for me. I don't understand why my needs are not being considered here. But
you were busy the day we called to reach out to discuss this with you.
Come back to Brooklyn, please. But the refs are all here. And there is daily multiple sessions in ballrooms in a hotel to go over everything. What's the shorthand version of what Referee Camp is looking to establish before we get into preseason?
Well, one of the things that referees are constantly sort of being asked to do and criticized for is a lack of consistency. Judgment is not something that's untrained. Judgment is trained, discernment is trained, and we do that through countless Rolodex of NBA plays, not only for the new transition take foul, but our points of education this year, are continue to be freedom of movement. We have bench conduct, we have respect for the game, we have traveling. And one of the things that's really important for your fans to know and for NBA fans to know is that we do train judgment. And how you train judgment isn't just like a fan would watch a game, which is to watch the ball and sort of watch it globally. We break the court down into responsibilities. And then not only do we break the court down in responsibilities based on where the ball is, so your responsibilities as an NBA official may change four or five times in a 24-second possession because of where the ball is moved. And with the frequent movement of today's NBA games, we're training how to go on ball, off ball, back on ball, and back off ball based on the responsibilities that at any given time time an official has. But even when your responsibility is off ball or is on ball, we have to train and do train the discernment through a sequencing. So for travel, when we're good at travel, we get the gather or the catch, we find the pivot foot, and then we wait on a legal dribble, the release of a legal dribble, before we move our attention to the defensive player. When we're not so good at travel, we skip steps. And like all fundamentals, players, coaches, if you skip steps, you can expect bad results. So if we go from catch to then concentrating solely on the defensive player's actions for fouls and whatnot along those lines, and we miss that step of finding the pivot foot and waiting on the legal release of a dribble, we're very likely to miss the drop step, the split foot travel. And, you know, those are important sequencings. If we want to watch point of contact on a jump shot, we train up, down, rebound. And what that means to a referee is I'm going to go up with the defensive player and make sure that there's no hits on the arm. I'm going to make sure that the offensive player comes all the way back down to the ground before they're, you know, allowed to get back to normal play without being fouled. And then and only then will I transfer my attention to my rebounding responsibilities. If I skip a step as an official and go up and then go to rebound without the down part, then we miss the turned ankles that we see, you know, with defenders stepping under a jump shooter. And we, if we skip steps, we miss plays. So we have hundreds of plays on, you know, 30, 40 different topics this week that we are looking at to train that sequencing, to one, train the responsibilities, and then train. Now, for many of our veterans, this is, you know, repetitive work, but that's what good work is learning how to make something a habit. And if you can make something a habit, then you have a much better chance to concentrate on the appropriate nuances that make, at the speed and power that NBA players play at, make officiating it really difficult. I think we saw this summer, and we had a fun thing this summer with Richard Jefferson, you know, out of the summer league, in which we let Richard referee a quarter. And he worked really hard for 5 days. And he got out on that floor, and here's an NBA player that, as a player, the game had slowed down for him over the years. But when you ask him to make decisions based on 5 days worth of training, the game moved really fast for him. And I think that that's very analogous to what happens to young referees up against old referees. The game moves really fast for a young referee, a young player, a young coach. The more experience you have, the game starts to slow down, you become better at your work. And our training camp is a helpful tool to give other people's experience, if that makes sense. That you don't have to just live with your own mistakes as a way you learn. You can learn from other people's mistakes through video work and other people's successes, I might add, to see and repeat what other successful people have done. And this is a great week to start our year. It's our training camp. And we hold it here every year. I mean, the teams have taken Santa Barbara and Hawaii and all the best spots. So we're left here in New Jersey, which we're more than happy to do, you know, your commute notwithstanding.
I mean, I would happily make the commute to Santa Barbara, Honolulu.
Like I said, already taken.
They got a lot of gyms, a lot of hotels. We can carve out some space. So let me hit a couple housekeeping items before we get to. We are going to get to the new take foul rule or adjustment. We'll get to bench conduct, the Dallas Mavericks rule, as I'm going to call it. There's a new light, a blue light. I didn't know a blue light was coming, but we'll talk about the blue light. So we'll hit a few of these things, and I've got a bunch of really great questions from folks on Twitter. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but some very thoughtful stuff from folks on Twitter. But a couple quick staffing things. Kane Fitzgerald is moving from the floor to the replay center, replacing Jason Phillips. Kane is, I didn't realize it. Kane's only like 41. He hasn't really been doing it. Normally, like the replay center's been like, okay, like my knees are shot.
Right.
I need this intermediary. That's a great place to go. He's on the younger side for somebody to kind of come off the floor into, you know, there's a lot of others too, not just the replay center. A lot of those of you overseeing officiating are former referees who have been logging 25, 30 years and your knees need a break. What's anything behind the move of Kane there? And is Jason Phillips now moving to Olympic Tower, retired, or what's the mechanics there?
Jason has moved on to other endeavors. And, you know, the Replay Center was put in, you know, give or take 9-10. I don't even remember the exact year offhand right now. But it's been a while, and it was a very small portion of our rule book. And it has expanded through the needs of the league over the years, but the room hasn't changed. Same size, same equipment, same, you know, we've tried to upgrade technology, of course, as we go through things. As technology has improved, we've most certainly have added that. That being said, we think the Replay Center has an opportunity to turn itself into a learning center where it grows and expands. And we're going to need strong leadership in that. Kane has most certainly proven in a very short time, 13 years, he had reached the finals the last several years, to be an excellent leader on our staff. And when he expressed an interest and we had a need, there was a real chance for a new challenge for Kane. And I think Kane was excited to take on not only the current work of the Replay Center in its, you know, current iteration, but we foresee the Replay Center growing in scope, to be a learning center, to continue to serve the game on a nightly basis as a Replay Center, but to add cognitive training, to add health and wellness benefits that are part of the building. And we foresee there being a possibility for growth and expansion. That's going to take a visionary and someone who can grow with it. We think that Kane is the person for that, and as such, he's taken on the vice president role to lead our Replay Center.
Does this mean he is also the primary person we see now when they say we're going to Secaucus to the Replay Center?
Yeah.
Here's Kane Fitzgerald. Because the first thing I think about with that on some level, maybe just being a media person, does he get TV training? Like, do you think? Yeah.
Yeah, we do that. I think the thing that's not truly understood about NBA officiating in general is the amount of training and the amount of work that we take in. We're giving NBA referees training on how to announce in arena today, later this afternoon. We have experts coming in to give training on how to present to that camera so that we have a little more consistency and articulation from that moment that we have found to be wildly successful. Not only do fans enjoy it, but our TV audiences enjoy that explanation. But we have some range of skill sets there, and therefore we're going to train it. And Kane will most certainly go through some media training so that he is prepared. As we all know, training leads to preparation, which then, of course, leads to performance. And that's an important piece to the Replay Center to educate and to articulate our decisions. Not every NBA refereeing decision, this will be a shock to Twitter and a shock to some of those that maybe requested questions, but not every NBA referee decision is correct. And my own career is a huge testament to that. But we do try to do good work and excellent work. And when we're wrong or when we're right, to be able to articulate that to the fans is an important piece. If we can't articulate why we're right, then maybe we need to examine whether we're right or not. We should be able to articulate our good work. And Kane will do an excellent job with that, I have no doubts. And of course, moments like this allow me to articulate our work.
I mentioned this, I think, last year when you came on the pod, but yeah, I mean, I count me among those who loves the innovation of, and it came, of course, during
the bubble
yeah. of the referees directly addressing the camera and explaining what just happened or what the interpretation was or what the review result was. I think it's fantastic. Like, there's no downside to that. But yes, there's definitely a range of skills in front of that camera
sure.
and presentation and enunciation. And you can see some of them who are just like, I just want to get this over with and let go of the button and walk away.
Right.
Like it's interesting.
But
we have to,
part of being an NBA official is learning how to live in uncomfortable spaces.
Sure.
You know, if you get a double team out at midcourt, that's a high-stress situation because you have someone trapped and the offensive player gets assertive, wanting to split the double team. And there's a lot of tension that goes with those kinds of plays. And we looked at some of those plays this week, and we had a discussion not only about where to stand and what to look for, but can you overcome your own tension there? And because the release valve for an official can be an erroneous call as a foul because there's so much tension there. And we talk a lot about living in uncomfortable spaces. If you're going to get out of being uncomfortable, you have to be willing to grow and learn and change. You do that through training.
Yeah. Speaking of potentially uncomfortable spaces, since we last had you on the pod, And he also has now been on the pod a few weeks ago. Joe Dumars is part of Basketball Ops. So let's talk about Uncomfortable Spaces. Joe Dumars, former bad boy, now discipline czar, among other things. I can't remember the exact title in Basketball Ops. It's another one of these long NBA titles.
He's our executive vice president of Basketball Operations.
There's a bunch of commas and a lot of capitalized words. It's all very confusing. What has that voice been like? What is the voice of Joe Dumars now, as opposed to when it was Kiki or somebody else in that room, as you guys are grinding through rules interpretations and competition committee things that are, you know, resulting in, hey, we're going to try to tamp down the take foul? Like, what's Dumars' voice been like coming from where he does in his background?
Well, you know, Joe's accomplished so much, obviously a Hall of Famer, and rightfully so, from the time he spent with Detroit on those championship teams. He has been a, you know, I believe an executive of the year with Detroit, and he built those teams up that then had another run at championships and won one. And so his scope in the league has been, you know, very large. And you to have that level of experience and to have that level and that bank or that Rolodex of ideas and perspectives on how to approach things, the team side, the player side, and now a league side, has been invaluable. As you know, Joe was and is a voice of reason, even on the bad boy teams. And, you know, there's a reason they've named the Sportsmanship Award after him. It's because Joe is Joe, and how he has chosen to be in the world at large is one of class and dignity. And we've really enjoyed, I personally have enjoyed seeing a different side of Joe. Not that the side I saw before was in any way negative. It's just that it was limited. You know, referees don't have outside the court any opportunity to interact. I'm personally thrilled about the future and Joe Dumars' leadership at the NBA and how it marries up with the work we do. And that's one of the things I think that maybe is not known is how collaborative basketball operations, referee operations, the international department, and how we're growing the game internationally. Referee operations collaborates with all those groups, and Joe's leadership is invaluable, and I'm excited about it.
All right, so all that sportsmanship stuff aside, what was the first complaint he had to you of a call you made against him or one of his Pistons teams that he was president for?
Joe was a wily veteran who was really good at his craft when I refereed him. I was young and not very good at my craft when I refereed him. So you can well imagine that he had more than a bucket full of calls that I probably was wrong on. He's far too classy to have brought them up. I remember a few of them, unfortunately, and he's been kind enough to keep them in the shadows.
Very nice of Joe. All right, so let's just jump into this. Take fouls. Talk about things that are wildly popular with NBA Twitter and NBA fandom in general. Like, this one is unanimous. I don't think there's anybody in the world who was against tamping down on take fouls, because take fouls ruin one of the most exciting plays in basketball, which is transition plays, fast breaks. We had a chance to talk about this during Summer League a little bit, but we have not done this on the pod. So for those who are just now new to, there's now going to be extra penalty for take fouls, what is going to be the interpretation? What is the penalty? What is the goal of the new wrinkle in terms of officiating take fouls?
Well, I'll start with the rationale. Any rule that's going to be changed or added is designed to affect both sides of the ball equitably. And we don't want rules in place that tip the scales of competition towards offense or defense. The idea is to be able to compete on both sides of the ball equitably. Some of the great, I know that transition is viewed as this offensive thing, and it often is. Transition often leads to an advantage, both in numbers and or situational advantage for an offensive team in transition. But we also know that some of the greatest NBA plays in the history of our league have been in transition on the defensive side of the ball. Most certainly, you know, we've seen track down blocks that have had huge impacts. Tayshaun Prince and Reggie and LeBron at various different times. And so from that standpoint, as well as many others, Dwayne Wade was great at chase down blocks. We want offense and defensive balance with our rules. We think transition and adding more transition to our game adds an excitement to NBA basketball that had been decreased through this use of a take foul. No legitimate play on the ball. Sole purpose is to stop a transition scoring opportunity. And we saw an increase 55% last season alone, while it was creeping up prior to that in years. But with that explosion of understanding that that created a defensive balance, I no longer had to deal with a transition if I just took the foul, it became pretty clear that we needed to address that. Of course, none of these decisions are ever made unilaterally. We have a competition committee. The competition committee then is our owners, general managers, players, coaches, some referees in a non-voting capacity give a refereeing perspective. Of course, I'm there to give a refereeing perspective. And as such, you get a very vetted process about what is good for the game. As you said, it became very clear that this needed to take place. It passed this year with our Board of Governors, and we have a new rule that states that if you do not make a legitimate, this is the primary focal point, if you do not make a legitimate play on the basketball, then you're in harm's way for a transition take foul, and it will be called as such. Some other indicating factors are, is that you give up on the play. You just reach out and grab with two hands. Or if you are in such a compromised position that you're not in a position to make a legitimate play, i.e. you might be laying on the floor and reach up and take a foul. We have some video examples of that from this past season. And so with those factors in play, you don't make a legitimate play on the ball, and then you take a foul for the sole purpose of stopping a transition scoring opportunity, then the penalty is going to be one free throw by any player in the game. We don't want to incentivize fouling poor free throw shooters. Any player in the game may shoot it, and at the point of interruption, where the ball was when the foul occurred is where we'll put the ball in play, same team retaining possession.
Right, so free throw plus possession, which is a pretty good disincentive. I think we discussed this back in Summer League when we met with you guys just to talk about, like, you know, why not two free throws plus possession? Why not other possible penalties? And this was where you guys landed. And I guess the goal for any of these, right? You're trying to dissuade that strategy, if we can even call it that, right? So I don't know how you know exactly where the tipping point is, and you guys are just taking your best stab at it yourselves, I'm sure. But is it this, the sense of league officials that this is, to the extent that we can almost eradicate this or get it way, way down and not, you know, 55% is a huge leap year over year. That's incredible. I didn't realize it was that much. I assume you're trying to tamp it down to a much, you know, a minimal amount. One free throw plus possession felt like enough to you guys.
It did, and lots of a lot of different options were discussed. It wasn't like that was put out and 5 seconds later the vote passed. That's not the work of the competition committee. There's many perspectives talked about. It's hashed out over several meetings so that we feel that that's the right process to get to a good vetted choice. We do think that it is more reasonable to start here and continue to monitor whether it is the appropriate penalty. If you put in a penalty that is so harsh that it alters a game beyond what is reasonable for this act, the clear path foul is two free throws on the ball, but in that instance, you have a clear path to a certain basket.
Yeah.
An advantage in transition is not as certain as a clear path. And those distinctions allowed us to get to where we think it's appropriate for this year. Of course, we'll continue to monitor it to see whether it has the desired effect to reintroduce more fast break basketball, more transition opportunity back into the NBA game. And the competition committee will continue to do its ongoing work and see where we end up in the future.
Coaches are on the competition committee, and coaches are the ones who are telling their players to do take fouls.
Well, that's interesting, because when you're on the competition committee, we ask everyone to take off their team hat and to look at basketball at the NBA level and what is good for the NBA and what is good for basketball at this level. And our competition committee members do an excellent job of that.
Who are the coaches? I should ask. Remind me who the coaches are.
It changes from – they're on three-year cycles.
Yeah. You know, so the current group is –
The current group is Taylor, Jason, and Dwayne.
Okay.
Casey. And Jason Kidd and so on. And so from that standpoint, you take your hat off and you participate in authentic discussions about what is good for the game. When you leave that room, there are rules in place that you as a coach have to maximize to the skill set that your team offers itself, and you do what is best for your team under the current rules and how they are written. We think that that's a really good balance because of the authenticity and the integrity of the members of the competition committee. We get league view in the competition committee, but once the rules are there, that's a coach's job, is to figure out what's the best use of his resources.
And it's not like anybody was advocating, I asked you guys this back in July, nobody on the competition committee or any teams was actually advocating for not tamping down on this, right? Like, this was universal along the league, too.
It got to
like,
the level that this really was realized.
Yeah. Even if they're taking advantage of it as teams or as coaches, they're only doing it because they can. They see it sucks for the game, too.
Yes, absolutely.
How much time do you guys end up spending on? So you introduce a new thing. Okay, there's going to be penalties for take fouls now, and here you are at ref camp. Is there an entire session now devoted to
multiple sessions?
Multiple. Yeah.
I mean, we have 5 and 6 sessions. Our sessions tend to run about 30 minutes, and we go from 9 till 6:30 every night, and every 30 minutes we're cranking out sessions. And so, you know, we hit multiple sessions on all of our points of education because that's where we want to attack things. But that doesn't mean that's the only thing we discuss at referee preseason meetings. We go over fundamentals, we go over other areas of concern. Last year there was some criticism of our group that it had become, even though we had implemented non-basketball moves and had done a really good job with that, to be honest, we had slipped in some other areas, and the game had gotten a little overtly physical in some other areas, and we had to address that in the first month of the season. We've addressed that this preseason meeting. So we're doing the work of NBA officials while we're here this week. But we most certainly have multiple sessions on new implementations, and we drive home that discerned judgment through example after example after example. If there's any questions, we take the time to stop and clarify them. But they will have seen 300, 400, 500 transition take fouls this week before they leave.
Wow. Including ones where people are laying on the floor and grabbing somebody.
We've got a few examples of those.
Good Lord. There's a differentiation thing that's going to have to happen in real time, right? What's transition? What's clear path? What's common foul? Replay comes into play potentially here. Is this going to be one where, when in doubt, referee calls the take foul because then you can trigger replay?
Absolutely not.
No.
And so a transition take foul is not going to be a trigger, and it's not going to be a reviewable matter. Now, clearly, there will be some opportunities that a transition take foul might meet the criteria for the stiffer penalty of a clear path foul. And so, and clear path is a trigger event for us. So our officials must make a decision on the floor whether this is a legitimate play on the ball and thus is or is not a transition take foul. They must go to the official score if they believe it may also be a clear path and declare what their decision is on the transition take foul. If there's some question about whether it is clear path and they are using instant replay, they can use clear path to determine whether it is a clear path foul or not. If it is a clear path, then the clear path foul is the rule that needs to be enacted. If not, it will stay either a transition take foul or a common foul based on the original ruling.
Gotcha. I should just ask you about replay in general, too, because we covered this a little bit last year, and it just reminds me of this, that, you know, some of the things that were put in play last year in terms of not having automatic triggers for out-of-bounds reviews in the last couple minutes of games, all that, make it coach's challenge only. Some of that was because replay itself had gotten to the point where there were just too many stoppages. So this is not necessarily introducing a new trigger, but it is introducing a new wrinkle that will be part of another trigger. Like, where's the balance there? How are you feeling in general about how often the game is stopped for replays? Because I know that among the questions I will get to from Twitter later is people who are frustrated with not just stoppages, but also the length of those reviews.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we made the decision that the transition take foul would not be a reviewable matter, and is that we didn't want to add more stoppages to our game. In general, the experimental rule from last year that is now our rule of no more official instigated replay based on doubt for out of bounds is now only reviewable by a coach's challenge. That greatly reduced the outlier games, specifically those really long play after play after play that was being reviewed it really had a strong impact and has been a positive impact on our game, that the coaches must make a decision about which play is the most important to challenge, whether that's a foul, a goaltend, or in this case, saving it for the last 2 minutes for out of bounds. And we think that that has been successful, and as such, it is now the rule.
So the league got its desired outcome when it did this last year.
Very much
it,
so.
It cut down on a lot of the drag.
It did. The actual, you know, the last 2 minutes, in decreased some, but the outliers decreased by over 60%. We had very few really long last 2 minute sections because we weren't going to replay for every out of bounds, and that had the desired effect to a great degree.
Nice. So speaking of things that were innovated or brought into play at this time last year or for previous to last season, and you know, cause and effect here. One of the crackdowns, or the big one last season that we talked about in the preseason, was what I call trickery. You guys call it the non-basketball moves, but trickery shenanigans, I like to call it dark magic. The baiting your staff into calling questionable fouls by guys jumping in various directions, flinging out limbs in various directions, all this. How do you feel about the results of that crackdown? Do we have any stats about where that landed in terms of, were there fewer fouls called? Were free throws down because of it? Was scoring down because of it? That was a big thing early last season. Ooh, scoring's down. It's because of the crackdown. What's going on? Offense is going to... And, of course, it all evened out.
It does always even out, yeah.
But what is the overall sense among league officials about the whether that was a successful campaign to get a lot of that out of the game?
Well, I say this to anyone that will listen. We have the smartest players in the world, and we have the best coaching staffs in the world, and we try to do our part to be the best officials in the world in being and delivering consistent work. And they're all tied together. If our work is consistent, then coaches learn what is allowable and not allowable. Players learn what is allowable and not allowable. They can coach to it and then play to it. And in concert, we all attack it from our perspective levels of expertise and or desired effects. So we don't really have a ton of, since it wasn't a rule, we weren't really tracking it, from previous seasons. But in the preseason last year, people are always going to, do they really mean it, you know? And so we had, close to 7 a game in the preseason last year where referees were having to make decisions on. Then in the regular season, at the beginning, it was 2.4, and then we got even down into the 1.3 per game range.
1.3
of a non-basketball move where a referee was having to make a decision.
All right, now the skeptical fan is going to say, it's just because you guys started letting a bunch of them go. You just called fewer of them because you guys got worn down, which sometimes happens with
by not calling them, we're not rewarding it.
Yeah.
And so they went away.
Yes, I've got it.
So they went away.
Yeah, in my head.
And the fact of the matter is that we really did a nice job with this. Again, I can't reiterate enough, and we're not perfect. You know, we make mistakes. We give into it from time to time. But on the whole, based on what we've seen from our strategy and analytics group, we have addressed the problem in an appropriate way. We delivered on our end, the players and coaches delivered on their end, and it's just, I think you can anecdotally see that we don't see near as much of it anymore. And then when someone does try it and we don't call it, you see it less in that game as a result.
So it worked.
It worked.
It worked, and your staff, you feel, was consistently doing this from game one
pre-season,
through game 82
through
the finals. Yep. And the players have adjusted. They've curtailed some of that shenanigans.
Yeah, and
shenanigans.
Our players really do a great job of adjusting to what is allowed. But if a rule is in place, they're going to go up to the line of the rule, as they should as competitors.
And I understand it, that is that crackdown, the non-basketball plays, is part of the points of, as you guys now call them, education.
Yeah.
I still think of it as the points of emphasis from the old days. The points of emphasis for this season, that is still one of them
is,
for this
Howard,
year.
Because, our points of education this year are ones from the last several years accumulated, including non-basketball moves. And the reason for that is that the game is in a really good place. And we've added freedom of movement, which makes our game the most beautiful game in the world. And we've made sure that there was an equitable freedom of movement on offense and defense, as we had to grow in the very early stages of that. We do now have a game that is not littered with non-basketball moves. And so we want to make sure that past points of education aren't then allowed to slip. So they're this year's points of education too, to maintain where we think the game should be and is currently.
Got it. And that list again for folks, that's the non-basketball moves that we were just talking about. It's freedom of movement, traveling, and respect for the game. It's like the playing the greatest hits.
Well, if the game is where it is, one of the things you don't want to do is add things for the sake of adding things. Yeah. And I think obviously with a new implementation, even though it's not labeled as a point of education, the transition take foul most certainly will add a new wrinkle to this year that we want to make sure we get right.
Okay, so another new wrinkle for the season is the bench conduct crackdown, which we will just call the Dallas Mavericks rule. You don't have to,
I will. Yes, I will not.
Also, possibly the Theo Pinson rule. If folks remember, you could go pull up when Steph Curry passed Theo Pinson, Mavericks bench guy, the ball in the middle of a playoff game. Mavericks were fined three times in the spring. The last one, $100,000 for a total of $175,000 for their. So they've earned this rule name, Imani.
Well,
like you guys don't have to say it that way.
They earned say this it one. Because we tend not to put a rule in place for one player, one team, one group. The fact of the matter is that this issue was born in the bubble, and the bubble we had no fans, and teams became their own best, support group and
cheerleaders
and rightfully so. That was the bubble was a real deal, and I think it's a carryover of that, but there's a wide range of implications that we have to address with this. One is just the integrity of the competition. You gave one example, but we have numerous. We've been looking at plays all week of numerous examples where the court is crowded, and we all know that one of the best plays in basketball, most efficient plays in basketball, is the corner three. And if everyone is crowded right up to the edge of the line in a prolonged way, that has competition integrity implications. But there's also safety. We have examples of someone taking a corner three, drop stepping to get back on defense, and rolling their ankle because of that. To say nothing of the fact that from my profession, there are safety and health and wellness issues where referees need the baseline to be able to appropriately call a game. So for all game participants, we think that there was a need here. And then there's some business implications. Standing up in the whole game in front of fans is not fan friendly.
In front of the most expensive seats in the house.
and so from that standpoint, we think it's time that we address this. And so the bench conduct is going to be something. In some cases, it had gotten so egregious that players who were not in the game were, on the floor during live action. And we want, and that's not really six people on the floor as much as it is, it almost always occurs, not always, but most always occurs down there as a competitive integrity issue. You've got a sixth person that's near a playing player. And we just think it's time that we need to address this. And we're still allowing spontaneous reactions. What we don't want is a prolonged standing just for the merely sake of watching the game.
Yeah. Jason Kidd, you said, is on the competition committee. So I imagine there might have been some interesting discussions when this came up.
Again, if you take off your team hat and put on the league hat, some of these aren't as difficult as we might think.
I hope Jason didn't spill any soda during those meetings. Going deep into the well for that one. All right, before we get to the Twitter questions, and they're good, the blue light, there's going to be we have a green light already for coaches' challenges, right? The green light stays, and now there's a blue. Are we just gonna have a whole traffic light?
No, in fact, it's the same light.
It's the same light.
It's the same light that will light up into a different color, obviously. And all of our innovations are born out of need. We saw at a critical time in our season that a rule that has been in place but has not come up at this critical juncture in a game seven, in which we had a scoring change due to replay. Every 2-3 opportunity near a three-point line, whether it's a foot away, a foot and a half away, every potential 2-3 is reviewed by Replay Center now. Those are no longer, and haven't been for several years, instigated by referees with the little twirly bird signal that they used to have. And as such, since every one of them, we have scoring changes that occur throughout the game. And in Game 7 last year between Boston and Miami, there was a real impactful play in which we had a scoring change, and it took several minutes to get that announced. And we want to reduce that time to as close to real time. We realize that there's a certain amount of time that it just takes to review a play. And for our listeners or your listeners today, it should be noted that Replay Center is a well-oiled machine. We have a replay technician, a replay operator that screams out very loudly, close 2-3, Dallas, you know, Phoenix, corner 3, and that triggers a senior replay manager sitting up a little higher in the room to then find all the angles for the NBA official that is assigned to the game. And within, you know, under a minute in that instance, we had an answer. All right, through that teamwork. Close corner 3, we immediately started calling up all the different 9 angles that we have. We even have access to broadcast angles if we need them. And we make a decision. We make that decision in a short period of time. But as the rule had been stated, we wouldn't announce that until the next dead ball. With a small amount of confusion, which occurred in that game, we missed a dead ball, which then prolonged it even a little longer. And as such, this year, the blue light is going to go on as soon as we know that there is a scoring change, all right? And that scoring change is going to then be alerted to all the game participants, including the referees, that a scoring change is coming. So let's say they yell out replay in the replay center, and it takes that minute and 15 seconds to get to a decision. As soon as that decision is made, we will make a call to the courtside administrator. They will then turn on the blue light, and that lets everyone know in much more real time, here comes a scoring change. Now, the referee's job is now not going to be wait till the next dead ball. It's going to be wait until the first neutral opportunity so that neither team is being placed at a disadvantage. So if the blue light comes on in the middle of a double team near midcourt and the defense has an advantage, we're not killing the game right there to announce a scoring change. After a made basket, if we have a player that's getting the ball really quick to try to push play, that's not a neutral opportunity. But if we see opportunities like dribbling the ball up, which clearly is going to be a half-court set, they're taking 6 seconds to dribble up and there's no defensive pressure and the defensive player is 8 feet off, that is a neutral opportunity. We're going to stop the game. We're going to let remember, the decision has already been made. We don't have to go over and review anything. The announcement will be made, and then the ball will immediately be put back in play. All coaching staffs, all players will know much sooner what the new game conditions, new game situation allows for, can make strategy adjustments based on that. We think that this is a real positive for our teams.
That certainly sounds like it. And I guess on top of that, coaches and maybe even the players, it's hard for the players because they're in it, but the coaches and certainly their assistants, their trainers, all the people who watch on and document everything and are scribbling everything down to track fouls and everything, they're going to be probably attuned to, if there was a close 2 versus 3, they're going to be waiting to see if that light goes on, right? Even before your staff has that neutral opportunity to inform everybody that there's a change, probably somebody on your bench is going to say, hey, coach, the blue light's on. They just changed the score.
And I think that through the incredible intelligence of our coaching staffs, in many instances, not all instances, they'll be able to put 2 and 2 together and realize what is about to happen. Yeah. And it may even impact their ability to coach better, play better, instruct better at that point, at which even speeds it up even more. That's the goal of this, is to give everyone the best information as quickly as possible so they can make the best decisions for their team moving forward.
And that's the same, literally the same light. It will just turn blue instead of green, but it's in the same spot along the scorer's table.
That's where you'll see it.
Yeah. And I can't remember. Is there one at both ends close to each bench?
Yes.
Or is it just, okay.
Both
so,
ends.
Gotcha. That's a fun innovation. I look forward to more lights.
Well, we think that it's an appropriate innovation to address an issue that teams have told us is really important to their ability to perform at the highest level. All innovations should support the game, and we think this one does.
All right, before we wrap up, let's jump into some of these Twitter questions because the people delivered on this. Let's start with... I can find this. Actually, let's start with this one. So, and it's going to be hard to read out some of these names because not everybody has real names on here, but this is at 6th and Juno. He was asking about the flopping crackdown, which of course dates back many, many years. Feels like it's increasing in prevalence again, he says, to the point of egregious at times in the last playoffs. Do you keep data on that? Is there any attention or plan to reduce flopping? Keep that out. I frequently make jokes about this myself, Monty. I'm sure there are jokes that your department does not appreciate about the idea. Every time a flopping violation happens and is flagged by the league, I say it's the first flopping fine since 1973. It does feel like this just kind of disappeared, and it's not because flopping went away. So any thoughts on where things stand there?
Well, I do think it has been reduced, and what I don't think flopping will ever go away. The desire for competition and the desire to fool a referee is inherent the worldwide in any sport, it seems like to me. And part of our job is to be able to discern what is a flop and what is embellishment. And so I think to some degree our fan bases think that anything that is embellished is technically a flop. And we've made a distinction between the two. If someone does take contact and they embellish that to some degree, then we're not trying to go overboard with whether we penalize that or not. If the sole purpose of zero contact and falling on the ground is there to try to instigate a call from an official, and the official then erroneously bites on that, that tends to be when we act. And I do think it's much better than it was when we instituted the rule. I think the you know, overreaching idea that you could be warned or fined has played a positive role. We're always looking to see where the appropriate place to penalize those is post-game. Of my concern, great concern, is whether the officials are biting on them or not. And, you know, that's my real job, is to make sure that our officials have the proper discernment. It is possible for, let's say, an offensive player to legitimately get fouled and also wildly embellish the fact that they got fouled.
Yes.
We, as officials, don't get to cancel those two out, you know, like, well, you got fouled, but I'm not giving into that because that's not our work. Our work is you got fouled, and then we may mention to the player, like, you know, I don't really need the extra help. I'll get this play.
The backward next snap is my favorite, I think.
Yeah.
And you grazed my nose and, oh,
well, or
God.
Even running Whiplash. Into the shoulder. And we, you know, those are the things that we train. Again, we make mistakes, but we're better at not giving into head snaps because we've looked at hundreds of plays in which we, you know, needed to improve.
Multiple people sent me this video. The video was originally posted by, and I hope I get this name correctly, Dionysus Araventinos, who said, one of the best leagues in the world, the ACB in Spain, is testing a new rule this season. When inbounding the ball in the backcourt, the referees no longer need to have control of the ball first. So it speeds up play, right? As soon as the player from the team that's going to be inbounding can grab it, they just go. And so the video is of that happening. And I had multiple people, including young Bingland 2, I don't know, Letterboxd user, sent me this, but he, among multiple people who flagged this, saying, hey, why shouldn't the NBA do this?
Well, I think I could foresee, right now our rule is as soon as the offensive player is in position to take the ball, it's our responsibility to get them the ball. So we think that that gives an appropriate amount of pace of play. I could foresee some issues that could make that problematic in our league, in largely in part to the investment that our franchises have placed in their players. If there were wet spots, if there were any condensation that we've been dealing with, there are a lot of things that our referees, for that little half nanosecond, they're taking in lots of information. You know, like, is there a wet spot that player safety is involved? Any of a number of those kinds of situations. In the last 2 minutes of each period, then we allow a reasonable amount of time for a coach to make a substitution. So I don't foresee that coming into our league. Currently, we like the pace of play that we get out of backcourt violations. I would never say never, you know, but right now we don't foresee that occurring.
Question that goes back to the take foul rule. This is from Alexandros FL 350. what's the reason for not applying the take foul rule in the last 2 minutes? He says of the period, but I think it's just the last 2 minutes
of the game. It's just the last 2 minutes of the game and or any overtime. And there was a strong feeling, unanimously, that we did not want to take a longstanding part of basketball away from teams, which that is to stop the clock and be able to strategize through fouls in the last 2 minutes of a game. That's been part of basketball at every level for as long as I've been alive. And the competition committee didn't want to touch that part of basketball. And merely having it be in transition, you should still be able to stop the clock and be able to, you know, maybe create a few more possessions if you're trying to come back from a game, or create a few missed free throw opportunities that help you, you know, get a scoring. A three and a one helps get you back in a game. And so that just wasn't wanted to be tampered with because it's a longstanding part of basketball.
It's a great explanation. This next one, kind of fun. So this is Div B at Stats Center. It seems like, and these are a lot of, like, fans have perceptions, right, about the way games are called. And, like, I always find it interesting because I think they pick up on trends sometimes that I don't. And sometimes maybe it's just you see it through just through the prism of your team or whatever. But it seems like illegal screens are called more often early every season. You guys hear this about a lot of different things, about aspects of the game. And then eventually become more accepted, especially by playoff time. Does the data bear this out? And if so, what can be done about that?
Well, in some instances, it bears it out, not necessarily in screens. I'd have to get that data in front of me. I think we did a really good job. Last year was one of the first years that we had a really consistent effort on all of our POEs throughout the entire season. We did some things internally in referee operations. We hold monthly Zoom meetings now. One of the real benefits of the last horrible years that we've all endured worldwide is that it allowed us new teaching methodologies that we wouldn't have really, I don't think, thought of quite as quickly in terms of Zoom. And we can put video up on Zoom. We have developmental advisors that work with our officials. So our staff's around 75 people. And we have 5 developmental advisors, and they take 15 officials apiece, and they work daily with those officials. And we hold Zoom calls as a group that we dictate. We have some technology pieces in place, a social platform where we're allowed to post. I can create a flagrant foul playlist, hit NBA officials, and it goes to everyone. I can create that playlist while we're having this podcast, and it could already be in 75 officials' inbox on this platform. And so we did a better job last year of staying consistent. Screens in general, there's over 250 screens on average per NBA game. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of screening. I think that one of the concepts that is, we want to be able to allow, rules should be put in place so that players can reasonably expect to play freely under certain concepts of rules without being so technically perfect. If a person moves an inch on a screen, does that necessarily make it illegal up against whether it was 99.9% legal, you know? And I think that to some degree, we continue to want to make sure that we call material screens that place defenders by that movement at a disadvantage. Most certainly, we want to address that. And I think we can continue to improve there. It's one of freedom of movement, as I said earlier, is one of our points of education. Within that, there is a strong sense that we need to get better at screens. My job to your listener and your Twitter's question is to not let that happen. And when I see those dips, I realize that that's a focal point for me to be more vocal within our group to really drive them to success. Because one of the things that is patently unfair is that if we're calling something in November, we should be helping coaches coach to it so that in June there's a good expectation of what officials will bring to a game. And that consistency, even if we're failing, is something I drive towards for those reasons. And I think your listeners are right to call that out to us.
A few more. This one's a pretty quick and easy one. How many games on average do referees work a season?
There's 82 games in a season for teams. Our referees average somewhere in the mid-60s. Of course, that's a little different for our first-year hires. They don't get mid-60s. They are still working by contract. They continue to work in the G League. That means that, as we talked about earlier, the game can move pretty fast at the end. There's a big difference in speed between the G League at times and the NBA, along not only speed but in combination with size. And we want to make sure that they grow appropriately. So they'll work less than 60, but they'll end up at 60 along with some leadership opportunities in the G League. That for 3 years, they'll continue to work as crew chiefs in the G League. That helps teach the G League officials how the proper arc of growth is. And it also allows them, if they had a really fast game in an NBA game that seemed a little overwhelming, they can go to the G League, get their feet back under them, and then come back to the NBA. And we think then that has proven year. Even when I was in the CBA, that was the methodology. And the CBA is not something many of your young listeners probably even know what that is. But
they know it as the collective bargaining agreement. No, they do not know the Continental Basketball Association.
Continental Basketball Association, which is where I came through.
A couple people asked about just kind of the composition of a crew. And I know you guys had talked about in the past, it's been a while since you've had the discussion about whether to add the fourth ref, I think. But so somebody asked about the fourth ref, and somebody else asked about the idea of keeping a trio of officials together as a crew, kind of like they do in baseball for multiple games. And is that something that has ever been looked into, and what would be the merits or not of doing something like that?
We bring some consistency to crew makeups through trips, you know, so you'll see three officials stay together for, you know, two or three games along the West Coast, or you might see two of those three officials stay together and then catch up, you know, with people. Scheduling 1,230 games is very difficult for, you know, 75 referees. There's a balance we're seeking there. We want to breed familiarity, but we don't want to breed dependence in our younger officials. And if you then have lesser experienced officials who are really growing to depend, you know, unhealthily on Joey Crawford's big personality, to use a referee from the past, that can really slow down someone's growth arc. We do want people to work together enough to have familiarity. My job, or part of my job, is creating enough training opportunities that we have a standard that we keep to as a wide staff. So right now, we don't want to keep three people together all year long for that reason. We do want to get people together enough that they have the familiarity. We think the three-person gives the right angles to plays. It also keeps our staff at a level that they can grow into strong officials. So we're very happy with where that is right now.
I'll get you out on this last fun one. There were a few people who were asking about things like, you know, traveling and palming and all the very complicated stuff. But we're short on time here, and I want to make sure you have time for your lunch before you get back to your crew. So I'm gonna end on this one because it was just kind of fun. This was from at Danny Wright too. When refs collaborate, or when, you know, guys getting together to discuss because they disagree on a call, are there rules to who quote unquote wins the argument? Seniority, placement on the court, who is most adamant? I never really thought about that, but yeah. When the three refs have to get together to discuss interpretations, like how does that go? Can two outvote the other one? Is it like in Minority Report with the precogs? Like how does that work?
Minority Report was great, but no, it's not like Minority Report. You know, there's a wide range of possibilities there. The crew chief ultimately is responsible for any rule interpretation. They have the final say on a rule interpretation. They do not have final say or even authority to be judging their fellow referees' judgment decisions. All right. If there is a getting together, let's say to whether the ball hit the rim or did not hit the rim, that has nothing to do with the hierarchy of our crew. That has to do with open looks and closed looks based on the positioning of our officials at the time of the play. If we have a block charge where the restricted area comes into play, the calling official, regardless of hierarchy, would point to the restricted area and say, oh, I'm making this decision because of the restricted area. That would be a signal to the two partners, regardless of hierarchy, to then be able to reconstruct the play. So if we have an official point to the restricted area and say, I'm calling this play a block for the sole reason that the person was in the restricted area, But a fellow official, maybe with only 1 year of experience, knew for a fact that they were out of the restricted area. It is their responsibility to go in and share that information so that the play is called correctly. So there are instances where the crew chief, if you will, has a final authority to say what the rule is at stake, but not judgment. Judgment is equitable across all three officials, and we grow based on their experience. The other thing I would end with is we hold those positions not lightly. We message a person's growth through scheduling sometimes. If a young person is doing incredibly well and they're an umpire, which is our lowest, least experienced designation, they have the opportunity to grow into being and getting referee assignments. If a referee who's been in a referee position for the position, not the title, is doing really well, then they start becoming a part-time crew chief. If someone is struggling in the role that they have, they can then be used in a role they're more comfortable in, referee to umpire. That way we allow them to see that they have necessary needs of growth if they're wanting to see the fruits of this work. It also means that everyone gets their schedule once a month until the end of the season. And at the end of the season, in those last month and a half, we give the schedule out in 2 week increments. That way we know that we have the people on the game that are serving the game at the highest level. And if we're vying for playoff positioning or even a playoff spot, we have the people on the game that are working at the highest level at that time. And we think that that's a really nice combination, both for what you're talking about, this hierarchy of calls, but also we make sure that the people who should be on games are on games.
I still like the idea that somebody wins the argument, that it's just like, who has the best rhetorical skills, you know, just they break out some charts and stuff and everything. Like, no, my presentation was better. I'm sorry, I win this
one.
We
want the quality of the open look to be more so than the quality of your personality or the bombastic nature of your personality. And sure. We think it's also the best way to get to true teamwork.
Yeah. Fair enough. Monty McCutcheon, man, this is always a pleasure. Thank you for doing it. I'll let you get back to your lunch, your staff, your video presentations, your review, and everything else. Thanks for the time, as always.
It's always a pleasure for me. Thank you for having me, Howard.
Appreciate it. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Monty McCutcheon. Thank you to NBA PR ace Jim LaBombard for all his assistance. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all, as always, for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that American Family Insurance agents can help build a customized renter's policy so you can protect stuff like this, or this, or even this. Case in point. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.